retrospect, not a great call. A large tank on a seesaw, a heartbreak and a free fall. We saw the snakes on a fresh lawn. We heard the lawns, but we pressed on. All day on a Sunday, the wrong way on a runway. I'm off the base in a fun way. Turn the sofa to blockade. The wrong way for the fun sway. I throw shade like I'm Bruce Wayne. With no name like the Goose Game. Most days it's the Wu-Tang. Some days it's OJ the Juice Man. Was 2 chains with a 3rd chain. I flew south like a bird.
I bled on stage at First Ave by Open Mike Eagle. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Ukraine, where U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has arrived in Kyiv on an unannounced visit to Ukraine, expected to announce a new package worth more than $1 billion in U.S. aid for Ukraine. This comes as the Biden administration is reportedly planning to announce it will, for the first time, send depleted uranium munitions to Ukraine, even though the weapons are radioactive and their use causes contamination that's hazardous to human health. Reuters reports the armor-piercing uranium munitions are part of a new military aid package for Ukraine set to be unveiled in the next week. This follows a previous decision by the Biden administration to arm Ukraine with cluster munitions, which have been banned by an international treaty ratified by more than 110 countries. This week, a new report by the Cluster Munition Coalition found 916 deaths and injuries from cluster bombs in Ukraine last year. Meanwhile, it was reported Monday one of the 14 so-called Challenger 2 tanks that Britain sent to Ukraine with the capacity to fire depleted uranium shells was destroyed in a battle with Russian forces in the village of Robotyn, which Ukraine says its troops recently captured in its counteroffensive. For more, we go to London. We're joined by Phil Miller, chief reporter for Declassified UK, an independent media outlet that focuses on national security. His story is headlined, Contamination Fears After Ukraine Loses British Tank. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Phil. Can you start off by responding, although you're in Britain, to the U.S., what looks like the Biden administration decision to send DU munitions to Ukraine, and tell us what you found in your exposé with the British tank that was just destroyed?
Thank you for having me, Amy. So I think Biden's decision to send tanks with depleted uranium to Ukraine has been made possible in large part because Britain led the way on this. If you remember back in January, our Prime Minister here, Rishi Sunak, announced that Britain was going to send these 14 tanks. And that was at a time when it was controversial just to send tanks. And that helped cross the red line. And after that, we saw countries like Germany announcing that they would send much larger quantities of tanks to Ukraine. And this has really been Britain's role throughout this war, has been to kind of up the ante and to lead the way on weapons supplies to Ukraine, despite the kind of escalatory fears about what effect that's having on the battlefield. So starting with anti-tank launchers back right before the invasion, to then tanks, to more recently even cruise missiles. This seems to be the role that Britain has played in the conflict, and it makes it easier for other countries like Germany or now the US to send much larger quantities of weapon systems that were once considered controversial. Now, the reason that depleted uranium is so controversial is because it's essentially a byproduct of nuclear waste, and it is radioactive. The UK stockpile even contains some trace amounts of plutonium. And much of this was made in the 80s and 90s, and the stuff that we've been sending out to Ukraine, some of it may even have expired. But it was used most notably in the Gulf Wars in Iraq. And there's been a long concern there about birth defects and cancers linked to the use of this ammunition in Iraq and also in the former Yugoslavia. And so when I revealed back in March that Britain was actually sending this ammunition with its Challenger 2 tanks, there was international outcry. Farhan Haq, the UN Secretary General spokesman, came out and condemned the decision by the UK to supply these weapons. And Russian President Vladimir Putin, quite predictably, used it as a pretext to send so-called tactical nuclear weapons to Belarus, which brought the Europe and the world one step closer to nuclear confrontation and the catastrophic consequences that would flow from that. So even before these weapons had been fired in Ukraine, it had already had an adverse implications for international peace. Now, the British Ministry of Defence says that there's a low risk to human health from using these weapons, and it says it's necessary because depleted uranium is an ultra-dense metal that's able to punch through tank armour in a way that other munitions aren't able to. So it's made as essentially a dart that's fired through enemy tanks. But this justification is slightly undermined by the fact that the UK military also likes to point out that Russia is increasingly having to use very antiquated tanks, including T-62s that were made in the 1960s, and even some armoured personnel carriers that were first fielded in 1954. So the UK military is kind of trying to have its cake and eat it with this argument, saying on the one hand, Ukraine needs very advanced anti-armour weapons, whilst at the same time highlighting that Russia is using very antiquated weapon systems. And even though some of the more recent Russian tanks have been upgraded so that they are capable of firing depleted uranium, the UK military is not able to point to any evidence that Putin has actually allowed his troops to use this munition type yet in Ukraine. So this is very much something that the UK has introduced to the battle zone. And the tanks arrived in April in time for Ukraine's counteroffensive, and they've been held in reserve awaiting a breakthrough. And it seems that only in the last week or so has the counteroffensive advanced to the point where we've started to see videos of these British Challenger 2 tanks in action. And most surprisingly was the footage that emerged this week showing one of them billowing with smoke after being hit, presumably by Russian fire. And this is said to be the first time that a Challenger 2 tank has ever been destroyed in enemy action. Now, I'm told that the crew are said to have survived the strike, but there's a real risk that there was depleted uranium ammunition inside that could be ignited by the fire and producing a toxic aerosol that could cause a risk both to the tank crew and any other soldiers passing through the area. The video is filmed by what appear to be Ukrainian soldiers driving downwind in a car with open windows, so they would have certainly have inhaled these toxic fumes. And the UK military's own health assessments that I've seen from the 1980s, when this ammunition was invented, show that they were very concerned about the risk of a fire igniting this ammunition, and they said that you would need to send in teams with breathing apparatus to deal with it. People would need to stay upwind. Anyone who inhaled it should be taken to hospital, and you'd need a contamination team to move in there and deal with the large quantities of soil that would be contaminated. Now, of course, this area of Ukraine is a live war zone. They're not going to be able to undertake that kind of decontamination efforts for some time now, and it will be further complicated by the presence of other munitions, such as cluster bombs, which we know have a high failure rate, which can make it hard for these demining teams to go in. And what we've seen in other conflicts, notably in Iraq, is that these tank hulls litter the battlefield for many years after the conflict. Children go and play on them, thinking they're some kind of climbing frame, and they can become contaminated with depleted uranium, leading to very rare forms of cancer.
Phil Miller, I wanted to ask you, when Britain used depleted uranium in Iraq in 2003, the government said it would publish the locations where DU was fired and also help with decontamination. Did they follow through on that? And has the UK made any such promises in the case here of Ukraine?
That's right. So back in 2003, after the invasion of Iraq, the UK military recognized it had a so-called moral obligation to help Iraq post-conflict to decontaminate any tanks that Britain had fired this depleted uranium at. And small amounts of aid money were given towards these projects. I don't think the decontamination efforts were actually very well resourced. There were shortages of even things like alpha detectors. There were serious shortcomings there. But at least the principle was made and there was an acknowledgement. What we've seen with the UK stance to Ukraine is they've said they're not going to publish the firing locations and they're not going to help to any specific decontamination project. So there seems to have been a shift, a hardening of attitudes over the last 20 years, even as the scientific body of evidence shows greater concern and emphasis on precaution to approaching this type of ammunition.
I wanted to stick with Iraq. And Juan, back in 2004, you did an amazing investigative report for the New York Daily News that found four of nine soldiers of the 442nd Military Police Company of the New York Army National Guard who returned from Iraq tested positive for depleted uranium contamination. Three of the contaminated soldiers joined us on the show. This was Sergeant Augustin Matos.
They looked at me like I had two heads when I told them I wanted to get tested for depleted uranium. They actually told us at one point that there was no such test for depleted uranium. And when Sergeant Reed went to Walter Reed on his own and actually went and inquired about it, and I guess they gave him a test because they were tired of seeing him, okay? Whether he got his results on time or whether the results are accurate, who knows? But my thing is this, I was very upset because I came down with an episode of urinating blood while I was at Fort Dix, and then they found a 2.5-centimeter lesion in my liver. Unexplainably. Now, all of a sudden, they're rushing to try and check to see if it's cancerous. Walter Reed Hospital told me it was benign. It wasn't cancerous. But the fishy thing about it is my wife came down just last month with abdominal pain, severe abdominal pains, that I had to take her to the hospital. She got tested. They thought it was stones. They put her on Vicodin and painkillers and as far as antibiotic, and they're still trying to find out what was it that caused it.
So that's Sergeant Augustin Matos, again deployed in Iraq with the 442nd Military Police, who tested positive for DU contamination. He also continued to talk on the show.
Well, I myself, while I was out there, experienced a fever one night, unexplained. I was fine during the day, and then it just hit me. It just totally knocked me out. I was in bed. I couldn't get out. I can't remember exactly what the fevers were, but also I had I was urinating blood while I was out there. It wasn't good. It was just a place not to be when you were sick like that.
So, Juan, it was really you who exposed this whole story of depleted uranium, and here we are almost 20 years later. In light of this, if you can talk about what you feel at the time was understood in the United States.
I think the important thing to understand is that this was a military police unit that had not been in actual combat in Iraq, but had been basically stationed in an area where combat and the use of depleted uranium had occurred previously. And so they were basically bivouacked or camped out in what was an essentially contaminated area. The amazing thing to me was how when several of them began to get sick, they didn't find any kind of receptivity when they came back home in the Veterans Administration for trying to assess their illnesses or trying to figure out the cause. It was basically the U.S. government refusing to even look and to find out what was causing the illnesses in these soldiers. So I think this is the problem. The long-term risks to anybody in an area where depleted uranium has been used. It continues, obviously, 20 years later, the same problem now in a new war.
And Phil Miller, as you listen to that U.S. soldier, of course, then there's the issue, and you looked at this with Britain and Iraq as well, with the Iraqis affected. And now we're talking about Ukraine and Russia. What is the scientific consensus around the health impacts of depleted uranium? And how has the British government responded to your report?
So there's a real issue in that a lot of the scientific research on this subject is very out of date. When Britain, when I revealed that Britain was sending depleted uranium to Ukraine, the Ministry of Defense here justified it by pointing to research by the Royal Society, which is Britain's premier scientific body. But I drilled down on that and found that actually the reports they were referring to were from 2002. So they were over 20 years old. And actually, the Royal Society had been quite angry at the time of the Iraq War, when the Pentagon had tried to use their reports to justify sending depleted uranium or using depleted uranium in Iraq. So, you know, you'll see this tendency where certain scientific studies are pointed to, they turn out to be very out of date, or the scientists involved actually don't think that their work supports the claim that it's safe to use depleted uranium. And an expert that I've spoken to here in the UK, Doug Weir from the Conflict and Environment Observatory, he's told me that there's a growing body of scientific evidence that highlighted uncertainty and recommended precaution. So that seems to be where the scientific debate is at now. And even more interestingly is if you look at court cases. So here in the UK, we've had at least two judgments where soldiers who served in Iraq and were involved in removing tanks that had been hit by depleted uranium from the battlefield have been found to, in one case, a soldier called Kenny Duncan. Three of his children were born with deformities after his service in Iraq, and he was awarded a war pension. He won a war pension appeal on the basis of that. So there's a court judgment in his favour stating depleted uranium poisoning. And in another tragic case, a man called Stuart Dyson, who served as a corporal in Iraq, he died from cancer at the age of 39, the young age there. And the inquest jury in his case found that it was probably depleted uranium that led to his cancer. So that's just in the UK. If we look at Italy, there are over 300 cases where the Italian courts have awarded compensation to veterans or their bereaved families for cancers that they've contracted that have been linked back to exposure to depleted uranium. In the case of these Italian soldiers, they were actually Carabinieri peacekeepers who were sent to Kosovo when NATO had fired large quantities of depleted uranium in 1999. And like your colleague was just saying there, these were peacekeepers who were sent into areas after combat, after the firing had taken place. They were bivouacked in these places, often unaware that depleted uranium had been fired there. And then they came back to Italy with all these cancers. There's said to be 8,000 of these veterans in Italy who are suffering from cancer linked to depleted uranium. So, you know, as well as looking at the scientific evidence, we also need to look at the court judgments and how judges have been looking at this. And it really is quite alarming to now think that this is going to be used or is being used in Ukraine in areas where, you know, we want Ukrainian civilians to be able to live after the conflict. On top of dealing with unexploded cluster munitions, they're also going to have this huge hazard of depleted uranium to contend with as well.
Bill Miller, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Chief reporter for Declassified UK. We'll link to your piece, Contamination Fears After Ukraine Loses British Tank. Next up, the first Africa Climate Summit in Nairobi. We'll speak with a Kenyan activist there. Back in 30 seconds.
Naquela roça grande tem café maduro e aquele vermelho cereja são gotas do meu sangue feitas seiva. O café vai ser torrado, pisado, torturado, vai ficar negro, negro da cor do contratado.
Monongambe, Rui Mingus, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show in Nairobi, Kenya, where the first Africa Climate Summit opened Monday. U.S. Climate Envoy John Kerry pushed for the establishment of a carbon market, but many African climate justice activists pushed back against the idea. Ahead of the summit, Oxfam slammed wealthy nations for delivering a pittance, they said, to help East Africa confront the climate crisis. According to Oxfam, over 31 million people are currently facing acute hunger across Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, and South Sudan, due in part to the climate crisis, which has disproportionately impacted the region. For more, we're joined by Eric Njuguna, a Kenyan climate justice organizer who's at the summit and also helped organize the People's Alternative Summit, which just wrapped. Thanks so much for being with us and for going to an internet cafe to find some good connection for us. It means so much. Eric, talk about the significance of the summit and the alternative summit that you helped organize.
So this is the first time there is an African climate summit, which is being held here in Nairobi. But there has been a huge push by Western governments and Western consultancy firms like McKinsey and Company, who have been pushing for carbon markets. And this doesn't represent Africa's interests, because carbon markets is basically giving corporates and global north countries a ticket to pollute, while they're offsetting emissions in lands owned by local communities and indigenous communities who are being kicked out of their lands in the name of carbon markets. And that is why, after we realized this, we organized an African People's Alternative Summit, which is running parallel to the Nairobi Summit, the African Climate Summit, to really give an opportunity and a platform for African people to share their own demands and their own interests in the Alternative Summit.
And Eric, could you talk about this issue of the carbon markets that the U.S. climate envoy John Kerry was pushing, that many corporations, multinational corporations around the world are trying to focus on in Africa, and the some people have called it the wolf in sheep's clothing?
Yes, there has been a report by Power Shift Africa, which exposes the reality of carbon markets on the African continent. People are being kicked out of their lands people are being kicked out of their own lands in the name of carbon markets. Yet John Kerry is here in Nairobi for the African Climate Summit, pushing for this very carbon markets, and no commitments from the US to actually cut down on emissions. And this just shows a conflict of interest, because on one hand, he's pushing for carbon markets, and when he's asked about finance for loss and damage, he says, no, the U.S. cannot pay. Yet Africa is bearing the brunt of the climate crisis, and people are dying. People are losing their own livelihoods as a result of the climate crisis. And people desperately need this finance for loss and damage, but also for adaptation and mitigation. And the commitments have not yet been made. So John Kerry, while he is here, does not have Africa's interests at heart.
So this is part of what the U.S. climate envoy, John Kerry, said in his speech at the African Climate Summit yesterday.
President Biden has now launched a program called PREPARE, the President's Emergency Program for Adaptation. And he has committed that we are going to help at least a half a billion people in developing countries, especially in Africa, to be able to adapt to the worst impacts of this crisis. He has committed the United States to work alongside African nations to lead the way in adapting to and managing the impacts of the climate crisis. And as part of PREPARE, he is providing, or will fight with the Congress and guarantee that we will provide $3 billion annually for adaptation for the $12 billion program that he believes is essential in order to be able to do our part to adapt to this challenge.
That's the U.S. Special Climate Envoy, John Kerry, addressing the climate summit in Kenya. Eric Njuguna is with us at a internet cafe in Nairobi right now, a Kenyan climate justice organizer. Can you respond to what he has just promised, Eric, and also talk about how multinationals have benefited from mining across the African continent, particularly the cobalt mining, most notoriously in Congo, and what you are calling for?
Okay. So the first thing is that John Kerry has promised finance for adaptation and mitigation. But the reality of all climate finance that has been given, it has been in debt-creating forms, meaning that global South countries, including African countries, have to pay back to global North countries for a crisis they had the least role in causing. And that is why here at the African Climate Summit, climate justice organizers are calling for non-debt-creating finance because climate justice is reparations for the most affected people who are the least role in causing.
And Eric, could you talk about how you got involved in the climate movement in your youth? after a severe drought in Kenya?
Yes. So I became a climate justice organizer, not because I wanted to, but because I don't have any other choice but to be a climate justice organizer. Kenya is bearing the brunt of the climate crisis. And back then, when I became a climate justice organizer, Nairobi was facing lots of water shortages as a result of low water levels in the Ndakaine Dam, which is the largest source of water for Nairobi residents. And as a result of that, having seen the impacts of lack of water, especially on young children, I was around 16 at the time, and having seen the impacts of lack of water on my own peers, that pushed me to take action. And that is why I became a climate justice organizer.
And can you respond to your own president, to William Ruto, who said the African continent is losing 5% to 15% of its gross domestic product growth every year to the widespread impacts of climate change? And what you think needs to be done on the African continent by Africans, though you are not the ones who have created the catastrophe of the climate today?
Yes, our president is right that African countries are bearing the brunt of the climate crisis, and that even translates to us losing a huge percent of our GDP. And one thing that Africans need to focus on, and that is my message to African leaders here at the African Climate Summit, is to focus on phasing out all fossil fuels, as well as massively investing in renewable and publicly led renewable energy, so that energy is offered to Africans as a common good and not a commodity. Through the Just Energy Transition programs that have been signed between Global North countries and South Africa, Senegal, Indonesia, they have been pushing for a lot of privatization, and African civil society have been pushing against this. The second thing is calling for climate finance. We need non-debt creating climate finance to support Global South countries in adaptation and mitigation, but also a separate loss and damage finance facility to support those who have lost their own lives and livelihoods as a result of the climate crisis. And then the third thing is that Africa has huge access to minerals that that are necessary to power the just transition to a renewable energy future. Yet we don't want to follow the same pattern where multinationals and Global North countries have been benefiting from our own minerals. And that is why we need to stand strong and develop frameworks that can make sure that countries that like the DRC, where cobalt is being mined, are benefiting from these resources, but also stopping child labor in the supply chain of these minerals. UNICEF estimates that around 40,000 children are involved in the mining of cobalt in the DRC, and we need to put an end to this.
And Eric, could you talk as well, not just about the role of the Western multinationals and the United States, but also of China, the world's largest trading partner, also the current largest emitter of heat-trapping gases, though historically not. China's role, especially on the African continent.
Yes, multiple Global North countries, especially multiple Global North countries, and multinationals here at the African Climate Summit. Wait, sorry, could you repeat that question?
The role of China in Africa when it comes to the climate crisis.
Yes. So China is one of the largest emitters, but they have also been investing in renewable energy in the continent, but also in China, which is one of the leaders in developing solar panels and also technology to power renewable energy. But what we want as African countries is also technology transfer. And that is something that Africa, China has been working in collaboration with African countries to ensure that there is technology transfer. And these technologies are not only being developed and they maintain the patents and the rights to the use of these technologies.
Well, Eric and Njuguna, we want to thank you so much for being with us and even being able to hear us in the Internet Cafe you're in Nairobi, Kenya. Eric Njuguna is a Kenyan climate justice organizer and campaigner. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Are you interested in radio, community-based media? You can join CJSF 90.1. We're a volunteer-run community radio station, and we always have space for new volunteers to become programmers, review music, edit audio, and so much more. All the training is provided, and anyone can join. To volunteer, email our volunteer coordinator, Noel, at vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Again, that's vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Or you can visit our website, cjsf.ca. It's CJSF 90.1, diverse, independent, and yours.